This episode of the Deck Tees Podcast is brought to you by Gathering Magic and CoolStuffInc.com. Become a part of their customer rewards program when you make any purchase and receive discounts on all future orders. That is CoolStuffInc.com. Episode 101 of the Deck Tees Podcast. I am your host, Erin Campbell. My guest today was recently featured in an expose in the Washington Post about women in magic. You can also find her traveling across the country, spreading the gospel of high tide. She is Feline Longmore. Hello.
Hello. Sorry, I just had to pick something up.
I'm guessing this is your first time.
Either way. Yeah, as far as going across the country goes, I will be in St. Louis this weekend, Atlanta next weekend, Indianapolis the weekend after that. And then there's no opens for like 3 weeks in October, so I'm going to get bored.
Jeez, you are a busy little bee.
I can't help it. Yeah. I'm just like, I don't know, like since this year I've been grinding the open series a lot more. And last year I only did 6 opens, and this year I think I've done at least 20.
I love that you say only 6 opens, like that's a small number.
Well, okay. I guess you have a point there. Well, compared to 20, it's way different. So
Sure. I have to say, I'm very jealous of you and my friend Charlotte Sable, because you guys have these awesome Bond girl names like Feline Longmore, Charlotte Sable. And then you get me. That's just Erin Campbell. It just doesn't have the same, you know, punch.
I guess if you want to, you could say Erin Campbell Soup, but I think that's not very threatening. Sorry.
That's okay. That's one of the things I love about you is your name. Your name is so dynamic. And that's why it's so fun to say Feline Longmore. You know, you can't say it just normal. You can't be like, oh, that's a Feline Longmore. No, you've got to say it spicy, you know?
Yeah, the last name supposedly is from Australia, but I don't actually know for sure, because the rumor is that it was taken from like one half of the family that was from Australia, and ours is not. And if ours is not, then I don't know where I'm from. That's what I was told.
You're a magic player without a home. That's very...
Well, technically, if you look at where I go every weekend, I don't have a home. I go from one place to the next. So
that is true. You know, you are living that grind lifestyle, which we're going to talk about today. So the first thing I want to talk about is this Washington Post article that came out a week or two ago. Was a big deal, got spread around like wildfire. How did you become involved with the paper and the story?
A few days or maybe a week before going to D.C. Actually, I think about 3 weeks or so before going to D.C., somebody messaged me something on Facebook and said somebody was going to contact me because they wanted to do a story. And then like a week or so before I left, I was contacted, and they said that they wanted to see what I was doing there, and if I could get something. And I said, well, I'll be there for 2 days. I'll be there both days, and whatever you want to do, we can do. And so I went there, and on Sunday, they just started asking me questions, and they pretty much let me know that I would be, like, I guess the centerpiece or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so they just kind of asked me the questions that were in the article. There were other things they asked me that weren't put in there, but usually when you do something like that, you ask like 100 questions and you only use about 10 to 15 of them, because you can only write so much and you have to put in what's the most interesting.
Sure.
And that's just sort of how that happened. They asked me questions throughout the day. I fizzled 4 times in the first 6 matches. Mm-hmm. So a lot of my matches went to time, so I didn't get as much time as I wanted to talk to them, because mm-hmm. normally I try to not fizzle. And sometimes I go to opens and I don't fizzle, and sometimes I go to opens and I fizzle 4 times in the first 6 matches. So I did not make the top 64 that day.
So were they asking, so there was somebody there, I just want to clarify, and they were asking you the questions in between rounds?
Yes, whenever I had time, they were asking me different questions, like how I got into magic, how I came about, who I am, how did I get here, how am I doing this, why am I doing this, you know, what are my plans, just basically wanted to know everything they could about what I was doing and where I was going.
And were you happy with the way the article turned out?
Yes. As long as anything that I'm doing or I'm involved in comes out positive, and it comes out as a good thing for the community, I can't get mad about that at all. And it seemed like it was generally a good thing. I believe there was some criticism from other people saying that it kind of portrayed the other side in a bit of a negative light. I'm not really a good judge of that, but I'm hoping that's not the case, and it came out good for everyone, so.
Yeah, I didn't hear that. I actually heard, I mean, the only things I really heard about it was, I heard the positive things. I think a lot of people that I know were happy with it, and they were happy with it because they actually felt like it didn't cast the other side in a bad light, that it and the article ended in a very, we're all in this together kind of tone, which I think a lot of people were happy about. I know Tifa said she felt like some of her responses might have been misrepresented, if I understood her correctly, but I don't think she was that upset about it. It was like minor quibbles. And I was certainly pleased with the way it turned out. And I was happy that you were featured because I'm happy to see you getting your due because you have a lot of people who enjoy you. I enjoy you. And I'm happy to see that. So I want to go back in time. So when did you first discover Magic? How long have you been playing for?
Oh, wow.
You too?
I started playing about 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And my sister's ex-boyfriend at the time they were dating at the time. And he just was playing the game and he offered if I wanted to play. And I'm like, not really. That's probably something I'd get addicted to. And after like the third time of him asking over the course of about 6 months, he just asked every once in a while. I finally decided to. And then I started playing. Then I got addicted and I got some cards at my local shop in Barstow, California. And before I knew it, me and a couple of friends, Thomas Alley and Chris DePue, did our first sanctioned Friday Night Magic together. And from there, we did FNMs, we did regionals and states between 2005 and 2007. I played Tooth and Nail in 2005, Boros Deck Wins in 2006, and Dragonstorm in 2007. And then I stopped for a few years. I went to Seattle. And then I started playing again because I had all these old cards and I wanted to continue playing. And I'm like, whoa, all these cards are really expensive now. I guess I can play Magic. And then I kind of discovered a few decks in Legacy, and one of them was High Tide, and I've just been doing that ever since. And I did my first open with High Tide in June of 2012, about 5 months before the Seattle that I pulled off in November of 2012.
So I want to go back about your first couple days playing Magic. So you sound like one of those people who just started playing and you immediately dove into competitive Magic or tournament Magic. Is that true?
Sort of. I'd say there was about a 2 month period where we didn't do anything sanctioned, but we didn't really know about it. Mm-hmm. But we had, for us, it was called Luke's House, and, like, we started playing Magic, and, like, within, like, a few weeks or a month or so, we discovered that somebody was doing their own Friday Night Magic because there was nothing in town, and there would be between 6 and 15 people in the house playing Magic till 6 in the morning.
So just somebody's house. They were just doing it out of their own house.
Yeah, but it wasn't F&M. It was, like, chaos where everyone played against everyone, or maybe they do a mini tournament where you play one game against like as many people in the room as you could and they try to get everyone in. Mm-hmm. But actual competitive Magic didn't go until like a month or two later when we discovered some stuff to the south of us about 45 minutes away, and then from there we just got into it. So there is, I would say, not right into it, but that was because there was nothing in town, but we did eventually go that route. So yes and no.
So what was it about competitive Magic that made you go that route instead of just being like an occasional casual player?
That's a good question. I guess we just wanted to be official, and we thought that official Magic meant like sanctioned Magic. So we got our DCI cards. We did FNMs. We did our first big sanctioned account. I think it was a PTQ mm-hmm. in Costa Mesa, California. We all did terrible, though.
I think we all did it our first PTQs.
Yeah, our first ones, we don't do very good. So, funny thing about that is two of my friends that went got paired up against each other. One was playing a Seismic Assault deck with, like, 40 mountains. The other was playing a Mono Black deck or something with main deck Cranial Extractions. Mm. And they Cranial Extracted their Seismic Assaults. And they're like, okay, you can't kill me. How are you going to win? Why aren't you conceding? And the other guy was like, oh, I can still kill us both. I have Flame Breaks, which double... I have Furnace of Wrath, which doubles damage, and I can cast a Flame Break, and we each can take so much damage we'll die. So, that was pretty funny.
Where there's a will, there's a way.
That was quite a setup. He didn't end up winning that game, though.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like your early experiences were pretty positive.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. Now, you're famous for being more of a Legacy expert, and you had mentioned when you were talking about the early days that you sort of latched on to Legacy very early on. What is it about that format that draws you to it that you enjoy so much?
Well, when I liked it back then, I made, like, my own deck. Like, Legacy wasn't really popular, Type 1-5, I just sort of, you could make whatever you want. The card pool was limited only by band of cards. Mm-hmm. And I actually made a Type 1 deck back then. I played a 2-land Belcher deck, but I played it in one tournament for like a year. And I'm like, well, this isn't really doing me any good. So I just sold the power and used the money, and I moved to Nebraska for like a year. But as far as Legacy goes, like, I just like the fact that you can play whatever you want. Mm-hmm. And I made like a black-red land destruction deck with Burning Wish. It was okay. It was, I guess for back then it was all right. But for now, the reason why I push it now and not so much Type 2 is because Type 2 is harder for me, but part of the reason why is because I've done a lot more homework in Legacy, and once you do the homework in Legacy, you don't really have to do much unless something updates, which isn't that common. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like the threshold for getting into Legacy is a lot more work, but it the work lasts longer, whereas with Standard, you're constantly updating and doing more work, and it's just... Plus, you can't really play combo decks in Standard, and I like combo decks.
Mm-hmm. Part of the problem I found, I didn't really discover until I stopped playing Standard. So I was a Standard kid for a long time. That was the only format that I played in. And I got tired of the Standard format that's going on right now, and I started playing Modern. And what I liked about Modern was the fact that it really emphasized the idea of taking a deck and playing that deck, and the idea that any deck could really stand a chance if you had the experience behind it. And part of the problem they had with Standard is I would invest in a deck and I would get 6 months with the deck and maybe that. And just as I was getting good at it, the format rotates. And then that deck is no longer valid anymore. And all that time I spent trying to learn that deck didn't really get me anywhere. So I started playing Living End when I first got into Modern. And I've been playing Living End since the holidays last year, like right around Thanksgiving of 2013. And because I could spend 9-10 solid months playing that deck, I got really good at that deck, and I was able to be to stand up on my own on PTQs and things like that. And I really like that about the Eternal formats, where the longer you play that deck, you've got a better chance with it, versus Standard, where it's more of a meta call, it's more the best deck, if you will. And I really like the format because of that.
Yeah, I mean, Standard is kind of the way that Wizards like stays alive with the game. You know, they produce new content, I guess, if that's the right way to put it, and it comes out and then everyone gets it, and that's where it's the most active, so it makes the most sense. But it's definitely more difficult with the constant rotating. They are changing, as you probably know, by the way that they're rotating it, and most people are glad core sets are gone, but I'm gonna kind of miss core sets because I kind of liked the basics of when you draft a core set. It's more basic, there's less tricks, and it's just,
yes,
for some reason I enjoyed that. I don't know why.
No, I agree with you. I'm not very good at drafting, which is very interesting because now that I'm in the Community Cup, it's mostly drafting.
Oh, congrats on that, by the way.
Thank you.
I did vote for you after you messaged me. So.
Oh, thank you. But anyways, but I've never been good at drafting. And, I remember when M14 came out, I started getting kind of okay at it. And I was getting my curve down. And I was getting the concept of bread down, you know, bombs, removal, evasion, what have you. And then Theros block came out. And Theros completely threw it out the window. So, with Theros, you might have your one drops, you got your two drops, then you've got your five drops. And it's like, well, what about your threes and your fours? You don't need them. You've got enchantments. And I was just getting the hang of it. And now I'm just like, I don't know what to do. And the idea of Voltron magic, where you take one creature, fatten it up with auras, and throw it at somebody, I didn't like that. And I was very happy to get back to, the normal drafting, if you will, where you go back to your two drops and your three drops and your four drops, and you're a good girl, and you've got your 17 lands and your so many creatures. And I can hang with that. But when you throw a wrench in it and you complicate it, I get lost. So I'll miss that about core sets too, is it's very, easy for folks like me.
So. Yeah. I think my one of the reasons why I like the core set so much is I did a 10th edition draft, and I was getting so many good mono black cards. I just drafted mono black in third pack. Somebody passed me, excuse me. Somebody passed me a Phage the Untouchable, and I was like, I'm taking that. And I asked them after the draft. I said, why'd you pass that? And they're like, because it has four black in it. No one's gonna play mono black. And I'm like, well, okay, that's not what happened for me. It was just a luck factor that happened that way, but it was very interesting.
I remember when I was at Gen Con last year, not the Gen Con that just happened, but the one before that, I was doing a Team Trios event with my friends John and Tom. And so we had one person be the sliver person because all the slivers were in the set. So when you're opening so many packs for Team Trios, it's like, all right, you play slivers. And then I was mono blue girl because you could literally be mono blue in M14 and be fine. So I just played a mono blue deck. And then my other friend was the sacrifice black red guy. So he would just sack things to things and have fun. And yeah, you can totally just be mono something and make it work. So, as a Legacy player, how do you feel about Wizards and Legacy? Like, do you think they support it enough, or do you think they could do more for it? Like, what's your attitude on that?
Well, they can do more for any format if they wanted. They could do more for Standard by increasing or decreasing the time it takes for rotation and making Standard bigger. They could do more for Modern by reprinting stuff that's older that people would want. I mean, in the argument of that in and of itself, though, by comparison to the other formats, obviously Legacy players probably feel they're a little left out. I can definitely see that. But because of the whole reserve list thing, unless they change that, I don't really know what more they can do. Uh-huh. They can probably reprint some stuff, but if like they reprinted fetch lines, which is awesome. Uh-huh. They're doing that now. But that's probably going to cause the fetch line price will go down. But that means the dual land price will probably go up because the demand will increase if people use the fetch lands to get in and then you just need duels. Well, the dual land demand will go up. So unless they do something about that, which they're not so much doing, I guess, I don't know. I don't really know how that answers that question. Mm-hmm. I would say there could be more support.
Okay. So when you hear people say, you know, Legacy's dying, nobody's playing Legacy, that's kind of bullshit, right?
That's interesting. It depends on where you are.
Yeah.
I've been in different regions of the country, and at the local scene in some areas, it is dying. Mm-hmm. But when I go to opens, every single time I go, and this is now with Modern as a premier IQ included, I go to opens and they're like, yeah, we broke our Legacy attendance. You know, the last time we came here, it was 260 and now it's 285. And then I go there again and they're like, oh, we're 302 and last time it was 285. So the Legacy opens are not going down. And with the Modern IQs coming in, people are like, oh, Legacy's going to die now. And we go to the Modern IQ, and at the first one, which I believe was Baltimore, the Legacy attendance like wasn't even affected. There might have been like maybe 10 or 20 people that played Modern that didn't play Legacy. And then like the Modern, like basically the people that were playing Modern seemed like they were the people that were just going there for Saturday and going home. So as far as the Legacy attendance goes, unless the numbers start dropping, there's got to be people looking at that and seeing the numbers are not dropping, which means it's not dying. Dying means that the attendance is dropping, and it's not dropping at the high-end level, so at least not there. I think it's doing fine. Mm-hmm. Locally, in some areas, I can see it dying, but that's a different meta, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know in Milwaukee, we don't have much of a Legacy scene. I think we have one store that has a Legacy night, and it's on Wednesday. And they usually, I think they get maybe 8 to 10 people, if that. So it's very casual in its attendance, not necessarily its attitude, if you will. But I'm kind of curious, though. You know, it's interesting how the, like you said, the open attendance is so strong, but yet the local scenes aren't so strong. So I have to wonder where these people are playing and where they're getting their practice in if they're not getting it at the local level. But they are getting it at the open level. Like, are they just grinding opens? Is that all the experience they're getting? Or do you think it's like online and then they take it to the opens?
It's probably a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
I know that most local stores are like that. They'll get 3 to 4 rounds, but they won't really get 5 rounds for Legacy, mm-hmm. you know, between 8 and 16 people. But if they go through their roster and look at everyone who's been there in the past 3 months, it's probably more like 40 to 60 people, mm-hmm. but not everyone goes every week. You have some people that go every week, some people that show up irregularly, and some people that show up like once every 2 months. And when the opens come in, you have people that come from the local stores that will go. You have people that really only play in the opens. You probably have people that are competitive, but they don't have Legacy, so they borrow Legacy for just that weekend and play whatever they like. You probably have people that they love goblins and they just have their goblin deck and whenever Legacy a big open event comes down, they play goblins. And then you probably have a number of people that are regional, whereas you have an open in Milwaukee, but you have people coming from not just Chicago and Green Bay, but you also have people coming from as far as Minneapolis,
oh, yeah.
Iowa, and Central Illinois, and maybe even like Gary, Indiana, and places like that. So it's a combination of things that I believe fuel it.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've become synonymous with the deck called High Tide. So for those who aren't aware, what is High Tide? How does it work?
Oh, my God. You shouldn't ask me that.
I'm asking. I want to go there. Take me there.
Oh, well, I guess this is going to be a long interview.
Well, you know, just within reason, of course.
I guess it's sort of an inside joke there, though, in the fact that typically the deck takes a while to combo on.
Uh-huh.
But as far as High Tide itself goes, it's just a combo deck. It's the deck in the format where you try to mill your opponent. Well, there's two decks that you try to mill your opponent, but this is the traditional mill. The other one's Painter's Survey Grindstone, but that's different. Mm-hmm. But you set yourself up to tap and untap as many times as you can and produce as much mana as possible. Then you either reset your hand. You essentially reset the game, but you don't reset the board state. Mm-hmm. You cast Time Spiral, and you untap, so you get more mana. You draw seven new cards, and your deck is set up so that you'll benefit from that more so than your opponent 99% of the time. And then you just continue tapping, untapping, and making as much mana as you can, and you either blue send yourself for the majority of your deck, or basically more than like 10. If you can blue sun for 7 or more cards, it's a one-sided Time Spiral.
It's blue sun Zenith, yeah?
Yeah, okay. Blue sun Zenith. And then if you can do it for like 50, then you target your opponent and they just die. Because once they can't draw a card, they're dead. And it usually takes a number of minutes to go off, and you're casting dozens and dozens of spells. And it's also kind of slow. If you fizzle, I don't know if I'm going to fizzle. So sometimes it takes longer. And when I fizzle, that's usually when I go to time. Mm-hmm. Because you don't know if you're going to fizzle until you're going through the motions. And then you get there and you're like, oh, crap, I fizzled. And then you just pass the turn and it's like, oh, well, that was it. It's like climactic.
And what do you mean by fizzle?
You Time Spiral and you draw 7 new cards and you have no card draw available. You get like Force of Will, 3 lands, a Turnabout, and 2 High Tides. And you're like, well, there's no card draw. I don't have a top in play. I can't keep going, and so you're done. Mm-hmm. You pretty much run out of gas.
Now, I don't see very many people playing this deck. Why do you think that might be?
There's a couple reasons. I'd say there's about 3 reasons why. One is the entry barrier on the deck. It's something that you'd want to be comfortable with, mm-hmm. and if you're not comfortable with it, it takes time to get comfortable with a deck because it's somewhat complicated. The bigger reasons are probably because some people might play the best deck in the room, but if it's High Tide, they won't play it because it's just ridiculous. It's just too much work. Mm-hmm. And the biggest reason is probably because Candelabra of Taunos is in the deck, and they're like $300 to $400 each.
Wow.
So there's also that, which is probably the biggest reason. Because I talk to people that want to play the deck, and they're like, I'd play it, but I don't have candles. And then I talk to people that do have the deck, and they're like, oh, I only have 2 candles, and I need more, and, you know. So if people really want to play it, they'll get them. But it's not something that people will want. People are only going to play that deck if they really, really, really want to play it. You're not going to have people playing it that are like, yeah, I'm just going to try it out. Mm-hmm. It's either going to be kind of all in, or you're just going to stay away from it.
Mm-hmm. Would you like to see more people pick up High Tide, or do you like that it's sort of your pet deck and yours?
Oh, I would love to see more people pick it
up.
Whenever someone sees me comboing and they say they want to play it, I always think that's awesome. Whenever there's somebody else in the room playing it, I think that's awesome. I don't just want to see more people playing it. I'd like to see other people making high-end places with the deck. But the only person or the only people that have in the past aren't playing it anymore. Colin Chilbert, Matthias Hunt commentates more than plays it, but he's capable. Michael Burnett switched to Esper Stoneblade. He made an invitational top 8 with the Esper Stoneblade deck, and then he quit. The Hatfields don't play it anymore. I look at the top 16s with the deck at the Open Series in the past year, and other than one by Colin Chilbert, there's like no one else except for the finishes that I've made. And the only reason why I have the number I have is because I'm just going a lot. Mm-hmm. I'd like to see another name behind the deck, and whenever that happens, I'm going to congratulate the person and be like, that's awesome. So I'm hoping that day comes sooner rather than later.
Does that discourage you at all when you go through the results and you don't see as many people playing that deck?
No, if anything, it's more motivating because it's like, well, somebody's got to see this and go, somebody's doing something with it. It's still there. It must still work. And, you know, hopefully there's somebody, some sleeper High Tide player out there that hasn't been discovered yet, and they pull off a top 8 or an open win, and then the deck's at the forefront of the Legacy metagame again. I mean, not so much as Tier 1, but just on people's minds. Right now, it's not on people's minds, unless they're talking about me playing it because I'm just associated with the deck that much. But the deck itself, not so much.
It's interesting when you play a deck that's very, you know, not very represented like that. You do feel almost a sense of solidarity with people who also play the same deck as you, like Living End. You know, Living End is like maybe a tier 5 deck, you know, less than 2% of the meta. But, you know, when I find somebody else who plays it, I immediately want to like hug them like, oh, my God, yep. You play Living End. And you get it. And you just sort of bond. And there's this instant sort of attraction there. Or I find that I like people more when I find out they play. And you do sort of get, you know, initiated in this brotherhood or this sisterhood that I feel like you don't really get with the tier one decks. Like when you have a deck like Affinity that's 9-10% of the meta, everybody's playing your deck. You don't really feel that. But, you know, when you're the only one in the room and then you find somebody else in the room, it's just, you just want to attach to them and befriend them. And I love that feeling. And I just feel like you don't get that with the more popular decks.
That is very true. Yeah. Whenever I'm in a room, and I don't see anyone else playing, and I'm like, well, it's just me today. And then sometimes I'm in a room, and I'll find someone, and as soon as I see they're playing High Tide, we're instantly like, oh, you know, how's your build? What are you doing? Why are you playing? Et cetera, et cetera. It's just, you have at least 20 minutes worth of conversation that just come out of playing the same deck because no one else is playing it.
Or even like, you know, you said going through results, it's like, you know, I'll be at a tournament or I'll read the results of a tournament and I'll see somebody with Living End and it's like, oh yes, we did it. And it's not even me, but I feel like it's me doing it. Like I'm able to live vicariously through them. Or even if we are at the same tournament, and let's say somebody's doing better than me, if I were to see a Living End player, like the top tables, I'm okay maybe not doing as well because somebody's going to get in there and that's going to be awesome. And I love that feeling. So.
Yeah, definitely. If somebody else pulls off a trophy with it, I'm kind of going to want to be like in the background of the picture giving up a thumbs up or something like, yeah, somebody else is out there. The deck's not dead, you know.
I get it. I totally get it. So you're basically at a point right now, Feline, where you are playing Magic for a living. What is your grind like? Like, tell me about your travels. How do you do this?
Well, if depending on where I'm going, I have to decide whether I'm going by myself or with other people. I'm not playing out of Seattle anymore. I'm playing out of Cleveland, Ohio now.
Okay.
I moved out here this year because there's a lot more opens on this part of the, in this part of the country, and it costs a lot of money to fly from Seattle to Richmond, then fly from Seattle to Tennessee, and so on and so on. But if you go from, like, my ticket for Atlanta in a couple weeks, from Cleveland to Atlanta back round trip was only $71.
Wow.
From Seattle, it would have been like $371 or something.
Yeah.
So basically, I look at the open 3 weeks in advance. If I think somebody from the local area is going to go, I talk to them. And maybe it will be me and other people, and we split gas and hotels, and it's a little cheaper. If not, I go by myself, and I go to the event, and I set myself up to get there between Friday night and Saturday morning. I sleep on the bus, the plane, whatever. I get into town, and I just go to the event. Sometimes I get there early. If you talk to some of the people, they might see me standing outside the doors for a half an hour. Because I can stand at the terminal or I can wait at the convention center. So I just go to the convention center, get breakfast or whatever. I play in the event. Then Saturday night happens. I go to sleep at a hotel. And then Sunday I play. And then Sunday night, once it's over, I go back to the terminal. I wait for transportation. Then I just go back to Ohio, which is where I'm staying now. And I've learned how to sleep on a bus sitting up, which is something I never thought I'd be able to ever do. And I'm also getting past the gas station food shops with burritos and stuff that have probably been sitting there for 12 hours. And it's like, well, there's nothing else to eat. So, but basically it's a lot of traveling, and I'm very motivated to play Legacy, to play Magic, and to play High Tide. And I'm actually grinding for the Players Championship at this point. It's on my mind now because I'm in the runnings. I'm not in the top 12 or 16, but I'm in the top 32. And all it takes is one open, you know, finals to push me up there because of the way the point system is set up. So between all of that, as long as I want to keep doing this, which I do, that's what I'm doing. And I pretty much fund it by doing alters. And I trade alters at events, and then I either sell what I get to Star City or I keep cards if I want. And I just use whatever I get to buy the next ticket, and I just go from there.
What would you be doing if you weren't doing this, if you weren't on the grind?
I have no idea.
Yeah?
I was working at Walmart for a number of years previous. I worked at Walmart in, like, three different states. I'd probably just be doing a normal, real job, essentially. So something like that. Specifically what, I don't know. But yeah, as far as this goes, as long as magic doesn't die, and I don't think it's going to anytime soon, I'm going to be doing this for a while.
Do you ever miss the stability of, like, the real job and the boring life, or do you like the adventure that comes along with this?
No, I don't. I would say that the only thing I miss, I don't know. I don't really miss anything about the old stuff. I guess, like, because now I can work on my own time. I'm, like, my own boss. And I get to play opens every weekend. So I would say I like the adventure of this versus what I was doing previously. If I ever had to stop doing this, not because I wanted to, but because I had to, I'd be kind of sad.
Mm-hmm. Now, when I mentioned that I was going to be interviewing you, or that I wanted to interview you, I told you that I research all of my guests and I look for things to talk about. And you actually volunteered a couple of things. You said that you love meteorology and that you are fascinated with human psychology. Tell me about that. Like, what about those things do you love?
For some reason, I mean, as an example, when I looked at coming out here to Ohio from Seattle, I basically was motivated by two things. I could play more opens, and it snows out here a lot.
You like snow?
Of course, and you're in the Milwaukee area, so I hope you like, do you like snow? Or do you like?
I've learned to live with it. I can't say that I look forward to it. I'm actually more of an autumn person. Like, I love when there's just the right amount of chill in the air and there's leaves on the ground and turtlenecks and boots and cuddling. And I'm a cold sleeper, so I sleep better when I'm cold. So, you know, having just a little bit of chill in the room just does me right.
Alrighty. Yeah. Like, I like watching thunderstorms at night. I like watching the lightning. As long as it doesn't hit me, I'm okay with it. And then the snow is neat. And when I was younger, I always thought maybe I'd grow up and be like a storm chaser going after tornadoes or being in like the eye wall of a hurricane. But
wow,
that's dangerous. And you also have to go through meteorology school. And as I got older, things just didn't go that way. And I never thought I'd be doing magic full time for a living. But this is what I'm doing. And I enjoy every minute of it. And I guess going back to the previous question, maybe I'd be doing something related to that. If I wasn't doing this, as far as human psychology goes, I just always found it interesting the way people think, why people think differently, stuff like that. Criminal psychology is another thing I find very fascinating. I think on some level, a lot of people do, because it's such, you know, extremes from the norms or the averages of, you know, human behavior. Mm-hmm. So whenever something stands out, obviously, you know, it gets media attention or whatever, if it makes the news or if not, it's just something in your family. I'm like, oh, that's, you know, that's different. You know, it's just things that are different just fascinate me. I guess on some level, most people are that way. But what makes people tick, I guess, or the process of their mind and how they come to the conclusions they do is just something that's just very interesting.
Mm-hmm. And you can certainly find a lot of that in magic, too.
Yeah. I actually, if I ever sit down from a match across from me, I will usually ask, like, how is your day going? You know, I'll know your record because I have the same record. So what have you lost to? Did you play the previous day? How long have you been playing Magic for? Stuff like that. And it seems all very friendly and whatnot. It's just casual questions anyone would ask someone. But I think subconsciously I've developed that because I want to subconsciously answer the question, I'm still going to play the same regardless. Mm-hmm. But it's like, you know, if this person is like, yeah, it's my first Magic event, I've never done an open before, versus somebody who's like, yeah, this is my fifth open, I made top eight yesterday. It kind of tells me, okay, I need to be on my toes a little more against this person, or I can relax a little bit more. Even though it's not going to change the way I play, I'm going to take the person seriously, whether, you know, it's a 6-year-old across from me or a 60-year-old or whatever. It gives me information that I can confirm, and that just, I guess it just helps me move forward into the match. You know, any information you can get before the match starts, even from that, is something that, you know, it can't hurt.
Sure. I've been keeping track of the states that you've lived in since we started talking. So we've got Nebraska, California, Washington, Ohio. Are there more?
If there are, I don't remember.
Okay. A lot of traveling. I'm just trying to keep track of it all.
I lived in California until about 2007. I lived in Nebraska for a year. Then I went back to California, but went up to Washington after that. And I lived to Washington for 5 years. But since this year, I've lived in Ohio, and I'm probably going to be here for a while. As long as the Open Series keeps going and Legacy keeps getting supported, I'll probably be here for at least that long.
Cut to the end of the year when you're like, guess what? I'm moving to Maryland. And it's like, damn it, Feline, you said you weren't going anywhere.
Ugh, Maryland. I don't even know where I'd live out there. I'll let you know if that changes.
So one big thing that you and I have in common, Feline, is that we are both trans women. We're both transgender women. I'm very interested in hearing about your journey to how you got here and where you are now. So when did you first realize that you might be trans or quote-unquote different?
Well, there's two answers to that. When I realized that I was transgendered was much older and much farther apart than when I realized something was going on or something was different.
Yeah.
I've always known something was up since I can think of stuff back to when I was like 5.
Yeah.
But I didn't know what it meant. Like, I remember at one point when I was a teenager, I went to my mom and I'm like, I don't know what's up, but something's like, I think the words I use were something is wrong. Something's really wrong, but I didn't know what it was. And then like, that was kind of the end of it. Cause I didn't know, I wasn't exposed to that possibility. So it never clicked. And then when I was around 21 or 22 is when that, I don't know if that was the first time I was exposed to that possibility or if I put it together because of that, but I didn't realize what it was until I was like 21 or 22 years old. And then since then I was like, oh, okay. And then like, it was kind of that simple. It's like putting a piece of a puzzle together where the picture makes sense. And then there you go. I know that's very simple, but that's really how it came down to it. So
how does your family and friends react to your coming out to them?
That's a good question. I think I told my parents over the phone from Nebraska, which means that would put it around the 2006 timeframe. And that would put me around, that was like, how old am I right now? I guess I didn't really tell my parents for like a year or two after realizing it, but I told them over the phone and like, I guess it was somewhat of an emotional conversation. They didn't seem to understand, but I guess they were trying to. And then, like, I guess they kind of came around to it. And all I can ask is that they, you know, I guess they just try. And, you know, they still talk to me and I can still come around. So overall, it's been positive. I know some people are just completely rejected and that totally sucks. But nobody in my family has, I guess, stopped talking to me over it. There's a couple people that I know they're never going to understand, and that's fine. I mean, everyone has their own reality, and I can't really – there's nothing I can do about that. So as far as that goes, it's been more positive than negative, but it's had some bumps just like anyone else.
I can relate to you in terms of the feeling of always knowing. In fact, most of my friends who are some variation of LGBT say the same thing. You always know. You don't know what it is, but you know, you always know there's something different about you. And I can remember as far back as kindergarten. I will never forget it. I had a kindergarten teacher named Mrs. Stutzman. And hi, Mrs. Stutzman, if you're listening. And
mine was Porter Marsh.
Yeah. And Mrs. Stutzman had a daughter named Kristen who was in our class. And Kristen was a redhead like me. And she had this long flowing hair. And her mom would always dress her in these big poofy dresses with little saddle shoes and big bows in her hair. And I remember during story time, I would look at her and just stare in awe. And I would just think to myself, I want to wear what you're wearing. And not in the sense that I wanted to be a little boy wearing what you're wearing, but I wanted to be her. I wanted the ringlet curls. I wanted the saddle shoes. I wanted the little white pair of leggings and whatever. And I remember just wanting to be that so badly. And I would just stare at her for hours. And I remember, you know, growing older and having nothing in common with boys and relating so much to girls. And I can even remember being that young and getting mistaken for a girl. I always had very feminine features. And I remember my mom always used to make comments of, oh, we got to cut your hair again because people think you're a little girl. And they would cut my hair super, super short. And it didn't matter. We would go somewhere and it would be, oh, your daughter has beautiful red hair. And it always felt like something I was just sort of meant to be. It just was always a factor in my life. And I think the moment I figured out what it was I was watching an episode of Ricky Lake.
Oh, I remember that show.
Go Ricky. And there was a book by an activist named Michelangelo Signorelli. He's still on the scene, actually. He has a radio show on Sirius about queer issues. And he had written a book. And I remember hearing about gender identity disorder. And I was like, that is me. I was like, because I didn't think I was gay because I didn't want to be a boy. And I didn't, and the boys that were gay wanted to be with boys. So they didn't know what to do with me. And I certainly didn't like girls, although some trans folks do, and that's okay. But I really felt like that was me. I was like, I am meant for that. This body is not mine. This mind is what it is. And that was the moment where it dawned on me. And from that point on, I identified as trans, and here I am. So.
Yeah, I can definitely understand a lot of what you just said. Holy cow.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, stuff where you said that you viewed the other person. You're like, you didn't want to be who you were viewed as, you know, wearing a dress. You wanted to be, you know, in that same, you know, not just that, but like everything. And then like growing up when I was a teenager, I never dated or anything. I never like had an interest in, you know, either, I never had an interest in either, you know, I guess gender or whatever. I don't know why, I just didn't. And a number of times I would be asked, you know, are you gay? And it's just like, no, because I thought about that. And I'm like, that's, you know, two males doing something. I'm like, that's definitely not what it is. Because if it was, I would know, because you'd think about it and things would either work or they wouldn't. And it didn't work. So.
So, I can also relate to you in the sense that my parents not really understanding but still accepting it, where, you know, and I've also tried really hard not to put more on them than they need to know. So when I started taking hormones, you know, I told my parents I was taking hormones, but I didn't like bombard them with the, oh, well, you know, my testosterone count is this and it's going to affect this. I was like, I'm on hormones and that's what I'm on. And you know, my mom, when she was alive, it was very cute. She'd ask me, she'd be like, can I see your patch? Because I used a hormone patch, and I would like take down my shirt a little bit, and they just didn't think to ask a lot of questions, and I didn't think to tell them, not because I didn't think they'd understand, but I just they didn't need to know, and I felt like by letting them in like small doses, it was a lot easier than just thrusting everything on them, where it's like, I'm trans, and I'm having the surgery, and I'm on this hormone, and this is what I'm doing, and this is how I do it, and I just didn't really feel the need to go there. It was just, you know, if they had any questions, they would ask, and then I would tell them, and I just felt it was easier that way. It was more digestible that way.
Yeah, it's kind of like, as far as relating stuff to people who don't, who it's hard, you know, it's hard for them, it's going to be hard for them to understand what you're saying. I try not to push as much as well.
Yeah.
Even with magic, I'll come home from a tournament and like I'll talk to my mother and she's like, how'd the tournament go and stuff? And it's like, if I talk to my friend Chris, who I've known in magic, we started playing magic together, we still talk on the phone. And we talk about magic. It's like, how'd it go? I'm like, oh, well, this happened. I played against this deck, and I had this mulligan, and I had this crazy situation where a goblin charbelcher couldn't kill my opponent because I had a ley line in place, so I was killing their gristlebrands instead with it, you know, which I've seen. I wasn't a part of that, but I've seen that. It's crazy. Like, when I talk to somebody who doesn't understand magic, I can't really get into those details because they're not going to know what I'm saying. So what I have to say is, well, I went to the tournament. I placed this much out of this many people. I got this many wins and this many losses. And that's really about it. Like, you can't really get into the details because they're not going to know what you're saying. So it's understandable, even, I guess, from a magic perspective of trying to relate things to somebody who, you know, it's you're going across a barrier that's just there. It's not that they want it to be there or don't want it to be there. It's just there. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I guess magic and myself with our situation, I have that in common, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. It was very well put. So I want to talk about your big win at SCG Seattle in 2012, because I really feel like there were some moments there that shifted the community in terms of diversity and things like that. So walk me through this. So you're at SCG Seattle. You're playing some of the best magic of your life. You end up winning the Open. And as you're playing, there are these terrible things that are being said in the chat about you. Did you have any idea what was going on?
No, were you actually in the chat when that happened?
I was not, but I did hear about it afterwards, and I heard it was pretty awful.
Yeah, I heard there was a bunch of stuff going on, but I wasn't aware of anything. I was playing in the tournament, having fun. Then I came home, and like after I came home, I was still kind of in shock that I won.
Sure.
Like if you look at my interview on there or whatever, I answered their questions and whatnot. But like it didn't really hit me till the next day. If I get a win now, I'm going to be like screaming and stuff on there. It'll be way different. So, but yeah, I found out later, after talking to some people that there was like a backlash or something. And I think part of the reason why was I probably didn't look as presentable because I didn't realize that my hair was a mess. And I look at the pics now and I'm like, oh, I should have, like, now I'm self-conscious. Like, if I go on camera, I'll make sure that my hair is not a mess. And I was playing magic all day and I just didn't think about it. And, you know, but I guess like there was a negative response, but from what I understand, the SCG team, they took care of a lot of the comments, and they like deleted them or whatever. And they tried to do the best they could with that. So they've been really cool about it. And everyone on the Star City side has been very professional. I've never had any issues, even with players. I've never had anybody say anything to me face to face. If people are saying anything, I'm not hearing it. But if you go on the internet, people are going to complain about anything. I know even the SCG guys, I don't know why, when like one of the previous commentators that doesn't commentate anymore, is his name, as people know, is Gerard Fabiano. And whenever he would commentate, for some reason, like, he got the most heat from the comments, like, oh, Gerard's on, I don't want to watch. And I'm like, I don't even know why they're complaining about him. They just, like, some people just want to complain. I don't know why. They just do. And, like, when you have enough exposure, not everyone's going to be happy. I think the SCG team knows that. I think most people know that. And, like the situation just is what it is. Like, you have some people that, I think most people just were being negative just to be negative, but there might have been some people that were legitimately upset, and that's how they really felt, and they felt the need to express that, and there's not much I can do about that. But going to the Opens, I've never had any issues, and I mean, we're all there for Magic, whether you're working, whether you're selling cards, buying cards, you know, as part of the booths or vendors that are there, or if you're part of the technical team and you're doing all the technical stuff to make sure that the tournament's being broadcasted correctly, or you're a judge or you're a player, everyone's there for Magic. And I have not really felt any, I've never felt anything else from anyone. And 99% of the time when people talk to me, it's about Magic, and 85% of the time it's about High Tide. So
now I have to ask you a question, and I know I've experienced this, and I feel like it might be something. Do you feel like part of the reason you might have not experienced any sort of flack is because you're good at the game? Like, there's a certain sort of privilege or respect that comes from that. Like, let's say you weren't very good, or let's say you were playing a deck that wasn't so good. Do you think that you would still have it that good? Does that make any sense?
That is actually that's a very good point. I'm guessing that maybe people might think differently, but I still don't know if they would say anything to me. I mean, it's possible that people have made comments after a match, like, oh, I lost to that person, you know, or something. But I mean, I guess maybe for someone that's out there that doesn't have the exposure, but they're still in like a similar situation, hopefully they haven't ran into that, but I heard that people have. I think I even read a comment once that somebody said that they had gone to an event and they were like in the middle of their transition, and their opponent made like a comment to them that was, I don't remember specifically what it was, but it was like a negative comment. Mm-hmm. Like sometimes people will say something and they're trying to be nice, but it comes out wrong. Yeah. And you realize their intent isn't to be offensive, even though, but they just don't realize what they're saying is actually kind of offensive. And so it's like, okay. You know, and you can either correct them or you can just say, okay, and smile and be nice about it and realize, you know, try to be understanding. But sometimes the other person could legitimately be trying to be negative. And I've heard of stuff like that that's out there. And hopefully that goes away. But I mean, I don't know, like, hopefully that goes away. But I'm guessing that it just sometimes it happens. And hopefully anything that I've been doing has helped deter some of that. Maybe because of what happened in Seattle, there's less of that now than there would be if that didn't happen. And so I guess that's the most positive way I could look at it.
I'm definitely a big fan of visibility, and I think that it helps. And I've even had people email me and say, you know, I have somebody at my store who I believe is trans. How do I approach this? How do I respect them? And I've had people say to me from listening to the show, because I've talked about my experiences, and they've said, you know, I feel more comfortable because of you, and I feel like I'm better equipped to deal with somebody who is trans because of your show. And I feel like just doing what we do helps out with that, you know, if I may be so bold and pat us on the back. You know, I think that by seeing people who are out there and they're living their lives and they're doing the best they can, you know, it's a lot easier to accept something, I think, when you can put a face to it. And it's a lot harder to be prejudicial against something when you can't put a face to it. You know what I mean? Where, you know, when you see the gay marriage disputes or the debates happening, you know, it's a lot easier to say, well, I don't think gay people should get married. But when it's your uncle, when it's your neighbor, when it's your friend, yeah, it's a lot harder to say to them, I don't think you should get married. You know, having to look at them and say, I voted against your rights, it's a lot harder to do. But when somebody can say to you, I know somebody who's trans, I know somebody who's gay, I can't do that, I think it does something. I think it makes an impact.
That does make a lot of sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's not much I can add to that. That's very well put.
Do you feel like since 2012, the community has made some strides, like that things are getting better or that they have?
I was asked that actually in the interview in DC. They asked me if I felt that the community has become more diverse in the aspect of females playing Magic and my situation and whatnot. And I would, like, it's hard for me to say yes direct and know that that's the case. Like, for all I know, without that, the number of people playing today in different categories could be the same, or maybe they would be less. But it's hard for me to judge that. So all I could say is I would like to think that things have gone more positively than negatively out of it. And so I would say that it's likely that the answer to that question is yes. But statistically, I don't actually know if that's the case, because you'd have to find like an analytical expert, and I'm not one of those.
Sure.
But I would like to think yes.
Yeah, I understand that. So with that said, though, Feline, where do you see yourself going from here? Like, do you have any major goals that you'd like to achieve? Like, where would you like to be?
Well, if you want me to be literal, I'm going to St. Louis this week. I'm continuing to grind the open series as long as I can continue to do this successfully enough that I can keep going. I will keep going until I fall flat on my face and I can't do it anymore. And, what I do after that, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing over the next couple years, I'm going to be on the open series, a lot. Right now, as far as other stuff goes, I'm doing some dental work because I haven't had dental work done in like 15 years. And I went to the dentist office over the summer. And they said, yeah, you have like one cavity that needs to be taken care of and like two small ones that we need to watch. And I'm like, oh, I was expecting you to say my mouth was dead.
I was expecting you to say you were going to get those big veneers so that when you're on camera and you have your big win, they're like, and Feline Longmore is here, and you're bing, like the little shiny tooth, you know?
Oh, no, I'll keep regular teeth. As far
aww.
As that
but I was looking forward to making fun of your veneers on the stream. Be like, that bitch got veneers, you know?
I actually will have to Google veneers after this is over.
If you Google veneers, be sure to Google Hillary Duff veneers. She had some terrible veneers for a while.
Okay.
Yeah, they were too big for her mouth. They weren't filed down. It was a trip. But
I'll have to figure out how to spell that. But yeah, like after I get my dental work done, I'm going to finish my name change and have that officially done. And then I'm going to continue just more stuff in my transition that I need to, like, there's stuff that you do now, there's stuff that you do at the end of it. It takes a while and I'm like in the middle of stuff. But my name change isn't actually like legally complete. And because I moved, it kind of reset everything. And so I have to start the process on that again. So that'll be fun. But, if I can get enough out of what I'm doing to fund that, I will continue going to opens and that's what I'll be doing next. And right now I'm on dental work. So there you go.
Well, I will certainly be rooting for you every step of the way. I consider myself a friend of yours. I consider you my friend. I'm always very happy with you. I root for you when I can, even though I don't really know what you're doing. Like, I tried watching you play and I'm just like, what did she tap for? Why is she? Okay. Just smile and nod, Erin, smile and nod. But I certainly wish the best for you because I'm always happy to see more women doing well, especially more trans women doing well. And I really think we need it. So keep up the good work.
Yeah, I remember the first time we met in Seattle, you asked if I was feeling no more, and I said yes. And then I remember you had mentioned before coming there that you would be there.
Yeah.
And then we met again a couple times. We've met a few times now. And I remember one time I was in the store before Milwaukee opened last year. And then, like, you either walked in or you were already there. And I'm like, what are you doing here? And you're like, well, this is my local store. What are you doing here? And I'm like, oh, I'm in town for the open.
I remember I was playing FNM, I think it was. It was either FNM or they used to do a weekly standard event on Thursdays. So it was one of those. And yeah, I remember turning around like, oh my God, and I freaked out. And everybody's looking at us like, why? What's going on here? And yeah, there was lots of squealing and hugging and it was glorious. So
that was cool.
So I put out the call for some questions from my listeners, because you do have a little bit of a following. People love you. And let's go ahead and get those out of the way. So T2Brew at Twitter wants to know, do you have a guilty pleasure deck that nobody knows you like to play?
I only have one other deck put together right now, mm-hmm. and it's Belcher.
Which you gave me that one day to borrow.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
I forgot about that. yeah, I have Belcher, and then I used to have, like, Goblins, Pox. I made Zoo. I made Dredge. I did a couple other decks. I can't remember all of them. I even made Burn and Maverick, but I never played them. But the one deck that I would say I've played the most after High Tide, which is only at local events, is Prison Stacks, where I get out, like, a Trinisphere.
Did you say Prison Sex?
No, that's like a bad movie.
What?
Prison Stacks, STAX.
Prison. Okay, so prison with bars, and then stacks, like stacks of cash or stacks of Legos.
Smokestacks.
Okay, got it. I'm like, I want to play that called Prison Sex.
yeah. if that exists, I'll let you know.
Please do.
That would be an interesting thing. The judges would see the deck list and be like, this deck is called what? And then you start seeing all these cards. Oh my gosh. Anyways,
so you like your Belcher. Your Belcher is your guilty pleasure.
Well, no, I wouldn't say that is. It was fun when I made it. But the deck I'd say I've played the most after High Tide out of current Legacy would be Prison Stacks, which is you get out Smokestack, you get out Trinisphere. Your opponent eventually has no permanence in play, and they can't play anything, and they're just discarding your eighth card every turn and passing the turn. I would say that would probably be the most qualified for what I would enjoy after High Tide.
Okay.
But I don't even have the deck together anymore.
Okay.
The next deck I'm working on actually is Miracles, because I'm crazy. That's probably the closest deck to a prison-style deck that I could play that's actually viable, because Stacks is not like Legacy viable. It made top 16 in Columbus earlier this year, and that's the first time it's done that in like 2 years. Mm-hmm. So it's not a deck. But obviously Miracles is a deck.
Oh, yeah.
Play that at top 8. It won in at the Open this past weekend with it got first placed on Sunday. Dan Musser won with it, and then obviously Joe Lissette's known for it. A number of people have played that deck, so
you're forgetting Reed Duke, Light of My Life, Fire of My Loins, Reed Duke.
Oh, of course. And Reed Duke, and I guess BBD, but his version's a little different. It has Stone Forges in it, so I don't know if that counts. but yes, you are right about that. Philip Schroeniger is known for playing it on the other side of the pond if you're in Europe. If I said his name wrong, I'm sorry. there's other people, too. I can't even remember everyone. So
at Eons Torn would like to know, and we might have covered this, why High Tide? Because you said that you could play anything in Legacy you want. It's a very open format. Why High Tide?
I goldfished it when I first made it. I made it on Cockatrice, and I just couldn't stop playing it. Mm-hmm. And I loved the when I played Type 1 a decade ago. Man, I'm getting old. I played two land Belcher, and one thing I liked about the deck was the fact that you could tinker for Memory Jar. If you couldn't tinker for Belcher and kill them because you didn't have enough mana, you could tinker for Memory Jar instead, and then you could cast Wheel of Fortune and draw 7, and then you would get like Time Twister, and you're like, well, this 7 sucks, so I'll Time Twister and draw a new 7, and then you see a new 7, and you're like, well, this 7 sucks, so you tap your Memory Jar and you draw a new 7. You just keep drawing 7 cards until you can win, and the idea of a draw 7 deck is a lot of fun. Because it's kind of like you're resetting the game, because you're resetting hands. You're not resetting the board state, mm-hmm. But the deck is set up to take advantage of that. And so it's just a very fun deck to play. And I like the fact that it's a very challenging deck. Like some people they like to approach a format and they go, what's the hardest deck to play in the format? And they're like, oh, well, it's this deck. And you have to do all these things to win. It's like a giant puzzle you have to put together, and it's more ridiculous than anything else. And you're like, all right, I want to play that just because you want to do good with something that's just ridiculous and outrageous and difficult just to see if you can do it. And I've been able to have some level of success with the deck. And as long as I can continue to, I will keep pushing with it. And I like doing crazy stuff. Like, my record live at the Open Series, I had a match that was won. It was game two and it was over. So I asked my opponent if I can go nuts. And they said yes. So I continued to spiral. I drew my whole deck. I tapped and untapped. And then I spiraled. I did it until I had no spirals left. And I couldn't cast any more high tides. I was like, okay, I can't spiral anymore. I'm done. And I will blue send Zenith you for 2,560 cards.
Literally. And there was
still, yeah. And there was still 11 minutes on the clock. I probably cast over 100 spells. The Stormcat was probably over 100. It was awesome. And like a lot of people were watching. And I liked the shock factor that people get out of that. They're like, how can you do that so fast? And that's ridiculous. And that should never happen. It's like, yeah, I know. That's why this deck is awesome.
Speaking of drawing cards, at Mildly Vane would like to know, what has been your most memorable Time Spiral whiff?
I have had whiffs off of Time Spiral. I would say my most memorable whiffs would be three, actually. I had three fizzles in a row in Portland. I was playing against Bug. And I fizzled game one, and I lost because of it. And so that sucked. So I went to game two, and I won that one. I went to game three, and I fizzled again. I'm like, damn, I fizzled twice in one match. I don't think that's ever happened before. And then I drew a new seven, because I sometimes if I think I'm going to fizzle, when I draw my new seven, I'll keep High Tide in my hand and not cast it. So I have that all ready to go in case I have to wait a couple turns. Mm-hmm. And I kept the High Tide because I had, no card draw, and I just had to pass. And then I looked at my new top three. When I went on my next turn, I think I did a ponder and shuffled and drew Time Spiral. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to combo again. And then 3 minutes later, I fizzled for a third time in the same match. And I've had opens where I won't even fizzle once. So when I fizzled three times in one match and twice in one game, I'll never forget that. But the biggest fizzle I've ever had actually was bigger than a Time Spiral. I once blue sunned myself at a local Magic event in Tacoma, Washington at Exalted Games. And I blue sunned myself for 10 cards. I drew 9 lands and a Force of Will. And I showed my opponent, I'm like, you're not going to believe this. I completely fizzled. I drew more than 7. I drew 10. And I still didn't get there. And those would be the two that stand out the most. And I guess if you play 300 games with High Tide, that's going to happen once or twice.
Sure. So last question I have is from @Frost, and he wants to know, how do you deal with the rare cases where you make a mistake playing High Tide? And I'd like to add, just making a mistake in general. How do you deal with that?
Okay, I'm glad you added that, because I was going to try to distinguish between those two. If I make a mistake with High Tide playing the combo, that's not as common. I pretty much know whether or not I need to go for more mana or more card draw. And if I fizzle, somebody will counterspell me out, and then I run out, or I don't draw enough. But really, if you've played the deck enough, you kind of just know what to do. But as far as making mistakes goes, I make mistakes at every open. Even at a local event this past week, I had an opponent who was playing Ant, and I went and I did I don't know why I did Brainstorm on my turn. I think I was digging for lands. I just wanted to know if I would get them or not. So I was impatient on waiting, and I should have waited to cast Brainstorm. But when I Brainstormed, I put two cards back on top, and one of the cards I should have put back on top was Counterbalance. And for some reason, I kept it in my hand. Then my opponent goes, and I'm like, oh, dang it, I should have put it on top. He could, make me discard it. And then he cast Arrest, and I'm like, well, I screwed that up. So in the same match, I also did Force of Will. I had Force of Will and Flusterstorm, and he did Cabal Therapy. And I Flusterstormed the Cabal Therapy because it would be a hard counter. Because sometimes with Flusterstorm, you have to use it when it will be a hard counter, because maybe next turn, if they pass the turn, it won't be a hard counter. They'll have 6 lands untapped, and they'll play the first spell. And then you cast it, and they're like, all right, I'll pay 2, and then it doesn't matter. So I did Flusterstorm on a discard spell, and then they cast Ad Nauseam, and all I had was Force of Will. And if I would have Force of Will the discard spell and then Flusterstorm the Ad Nauseam and all the copies, I would have lived, because I would have been able to counter everything. Mm-hmm. So I screwed up on that too. So making mistakes actually happens a lot as far as Magic goes, but as far as with what I need to do with the deck, usually if I make a mistake, it's something I'm doing against my opponent incorrectly or whatnot. It's not so much the combo anymore, because if you goldfish it enough, you pretty much can judge whether or not you need to go for more mana or more card draw, which is really the two things you have to juggle when playing the deck.
So if anybody's enjoyed listening to you on the show, how can they get a hold of you? Where can they find you?
I'm Feline Longmore on Facebook and Twitter. That's where I'm active. I'm also at Feline on MTG The Source, but I don't go on there as much anymore. I mostly just update the meetup updates for Legacy, and then I have some primers. I did 7 primers on there, and I try to keep them updated. But pretty much Twitter and Facebook at Feline Longmore is where you, if you want to message me, you can message me on there. That's where I'm not only the most active, that's pretty much where I'm active at all. I'm not really on anything else on the internet. I guess randomly I'll check things like Reddit because it has a magic community. So you can message me on there if you want, but I don't go on there as much.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to say, Feline, it has certainly been a joy getting to know you a little bit more, and I look forward to seeing you at another event sometime soon. And thank you so much for coming on the show. This was your first podcast, first interview?
Yes.
Yeah.
I had to think about that.
I think you did a pretty good job, I have to say.
Well, thank you. When is your next open going to be? There's a Minneapolis in the end of October.
Oh, God. I am completely out of vacation time for the rest of the year. I'm actually having to use sick time to go to the community cup because I have no vacation time. So, like,
I won't say anything.
No, they were totally fine with it. I remember when I got the email from Trick Jarrett saying that they were inviting me, I was like, crap, I have two sick days and a personal day. I was like, oh. And I remember I was really excited. I called my boss into an office, and he's not really nerdy at all. So I was like, there's this thing, and it's a really big deal, and I'm not sick, but I need to be sick. So if I say I'm sick, can I be sick? And he was just like, well, if you don't go to this thing, you'll be sick. And I'm like, so that's a yes. So I have the thing, yeah. And he's like, you're good to go. So yeah, so I had to like scrape the bottom of the barrel for the time off to go to the community cup. So I will have no time off whatsoever after that. So I think I'm pretty grounded for the rest of the year. But they did release the schedule for the first half of 2014 or 2015's open, so I can maybe start looking at them then. I know that I'll be in Omaha for a Grand Prix in January. So. But it's modern. You're not really a modern girl, so.
Yeah, I'm pretty much grinding open points. So unless it's the open series, I probably won't be there.
Oh, I get it. It's, you know, I'm not right. I'm not good enough. I'm just going to GP. It's like a peasant. I get it, Feline. I get it.
Well, GPs and PTQs are actually where I'm supposed to be going. But I'm really into the legacy thing, and those are harder. And I want my matchups to be as easy as possible. I'm sorry. Like, I hear about people like Jared Betcher, who's top eighted like four opens in a row and three invitationals in a row. Like, he's top eighted the last four opens, and that's crazy. He's just like, he's doing really good at the open series. Then I find out how he did on the Pro Tour, and it's like, he only went 8-8. And it's like, yeah, it's because Pro Tours are really hard. I'm like, oh, I'm going to just wait for that. I'll worry about that later.
Well, thanks again for coming on the show.
All right. Have you ever been interviewed?
Have I ever been interviewed? Absolutely. I was on, there's a podcast that was on Mana Deprived for a while called Across the Table. I was interviewed by them. I've been on a slew of podcasts and just toot my own horn. Yeah, absolutely.
How did you come to doing your own interviews? What motivated you to do that, if I may ask?
Actually, so I was a blogger for a long time. I played World of Warcraft. And
oh, my God, me too.
Alliance or Horde?
Alliance, because my ex got me into it.
Feline Phyllis Longmore, you are dead to me.
I was a warlock.
Unacceptable. I've dated a couple warlocks, so we'll let that slide. But so I was a blogger for a really long time. I had a podcast that was okay. It was a smaller show. Not a lot of people listened to it. And it's very hard to break into Magic as an independent blogger. Like, unless you're under a major website, nobody's really going to know who you are. There's a couple exceptions, but it's very rare. And so I figured it'd be very hard to break in as a completely returning player, new player. So I decided to start a podcast. And me being me, I try to do something different. And I tried to do something fresh. And my show actually started off as being more of a like a mini podcast where I would do like 10, 15 minute shows. And I would just talk about like my first two-headed giant and my first PTQ. And around season two, like around my 20th episode, I started having people on regularly. And I noticed that those episodes did better. And I also noticed that when you had people on your show, you exposed yourself to their audience. So if you have, you know, by having you on the show, you will then retweet me to your 200, 300 followers, and then maybe they will retweet me to some of their followers. So I picked up really early on, you know, as a new podcaster, that was a really good way to get your name out there. And it happened to be something I just had a natural knack for. And then one thing led to another, and it was, okay, I'm going to have Darwin Castle on the show. And then Darwin would put in a good word for me with this person, and then I'd have Brian Kibler on the show. And
oh, my God.
And then I had Finkel on the show, and it just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And here I am today. So it just kind of happened, really.
Who would you say are the biggest people you've had on the show? And who would you say are the people you were the most excited about having on the show?
Well, it's interesting when you say bigger, because there are people who have big audiences, but they don't necessarily, they're not necessarily big. I found out, that was another thing I learned, is that having a big audience does not necessarily translate to being a big person. Like, for example, Kibler has 15,000 followers. But when I had Kibler on my show, they didn't really retweet me very much. Like, he did. He certainly did his part. But, you know, his followers didn't necessarily check out the show. They didn't necessarily retweet the show. They didn't offer feedback. Anthony Lowry, who only had about, you know, 700 followers.
Oh, I know Anthony. He's awesome.
Love him. Miss Lowry, as I call him. He had a very vocal following. Lots of retweets, lots of comments, lots of likes, you know. So there's an interesting correlation there where one does not always lead to the other. You know, so that's always something interesting. You know, for me, I'd have to say the people I was most excited about, I was very excited about Darwin, because I love Darwin. Big fan of Darwin. Kai, I love Kai Buddha, the fact that I was able to land him. For me, it's more about the adrenaline rush, where it's like, you know, I was able to land this person, where it's like, oh my God. And Helene Bourgeot was a big deal for me, because she hasn't really done a lot of podcasts. You know, for me, it's the thrill of the hunt. It's knowing that I've tackled this person, that they're coming on the show. I think Richard Garfield is coming on this month. That's going to be huge.
Oh my God. You.
That is the first guest that I'm literally humbled to have on the show, where it's like, you are Richard Garfield, like privilege.
I don't think it gets bigger than Richard Garfield.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm really, he's a doctor. He has a PhD in front of his name, but he's coming on my little dog and pony show. Like, whoa. So
Good luck with that. That should be, when is that going to be? I have to ask now.
Well, I had reached out to him. Actually, Darwin reached out to him for me, because he's a bit of a hermit. He doesn't really have a lot of social media. He doesn't put his contact information out there. So Darwin put in a good word for me. And then I got an email from Richard Garfield, and he indicated that he was interested, but he was busy until September. And I didn't want to email him on like September 1st, 11:59 a.m. Like, oh my God, I'm Richard Garfield, you know, be all freaky. I was like, well, we'll give him a week, and then we'll hello, Richard. My name is Aaron.
If he's interested, he'll contact you.
Right. So I'm excited. So now I'm going to give him till like September 7th. You know, I'm not going to jump his bones right away, but you know, I'll give him a week, and then I'll be like, I understand that you've requested that I contact you in September. So here I am, and then we'll see what happens. So yeah.
Well, if you don't mind me prodding you for a couple more questions.
Absolutely. Turn the tables. It's always good entertainment.
What would you say is the most what would you say are some of the most unexpected things you've had come out of the interviews that you have done on here?
Oh gosh.
Good and bad.
Absolutely. One of the things I have to say that's very unexpected, it doesn't necessarily happen during the interview, but people who don't necessarily promote themselves. Like, it's always been my understanding that when somebody's coming on a podcast or somebody's doing something like that, they want to get their name out there. Like, they want to spread the word that they're doing this. And it's always very interesting to me when I have people on who don't promote themselves at all. And not just me. Like, for example, there was a Star City Grinder, who will remain nameless, who came on my show. And he also did another show the same week that he did my show. And I noticed that he didn't promote my show. He didn't retweet his appearance at all. And at first I thought it might have been just me. I was like, well, maybe he didn't like the way it turned out, which is completely understandable. But he didn't promote the other appearance either. And it's very interesting to me when I see these people who are obvious personalities in the community, but they don't do that. Like, they don't understand that they are a brand, and that you should want people to know what you're up to, and you should want to do something that will open you up to more people. And it was very surprising. It's very surprising to me when I have people on the show that I assume know that, and they don't do that. It's like, why would you not? Why don't you want to get your name out there? Why don't you want to be bigger? You know, they don't seem like they really understand their celebrity quite yet. So that's always something that's always very surprising to me, when I just assume that's a given and it's not. And I'm like, they didn't retweet me. They didn't tell anybody they were coming on the show. Like, why? I don't get it. In terms of information, Mark Nestico, I didn't know that he was a former drug user. Like, I didn't know that he'd been clean for several years. That was something I didn't know beforehand. That was something that was not in the notes. That was
in the interview.
Yeah, we were talking about his past, as just his past and where he had been. And he was like, yeah, I've been clean for 6 years. And I'm going through my notes and I'm like, clean, you like to clean? I don't see this anywhere. And he's like, no, he's like, I actually used to have a really nasty drug habit. And I'm like, I didn't know that. when I had Jack LaCroix on the show and we talked about his alcoholism, I didn't understand how bad it was. Like he had told me like what his bottom was. And I was like, oh, so you drove your pregnant wife who was going into labor to the hospital when you were drunk. That's a bottom. That's bottom. Like you win.
I could beat that.
I didn't know. You know, I knew that he was going to be talking about his alcoholism, but I didn't know that he would be revealing himself like that. So those were some of the better moments that I've had. So.
Well, I guess sometimes you never know.
Yeah. And I think that makes for better entertainment too. You know, I think it's one thing when it's, you know, like, so let's say somebody gives me a bombshell in advance and they're like, I'm coming on your show to talk about this. You know, it's very hard not to build hype around that. But when you assume you're having a normal conversation with somebody and then they say, well, I was clean for 6 years. I was surprised as anybody else was. And I feel like my response showed that. And then I was able to follow up the questions appropriately with that. So it makes for better entertainment, of course.
Well, I guess that's always good in the end. If people are willing to talk about really deep stuff, then that means they're okay with and they're comfortable. Especially if they bring it on you kind of without warning, then you know it's probably pretty genuine. So
yeah, it's hard not to feel like it's a compliment to myself, you know, that people feel that comfortable to open up with me like that, and I'll take it, you know. So yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, so for anybody else who has enjoyed listening to the show, you can find the show first and foremost on GatheringMagic.com. The show is also available on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. Please subscribe and leave me a review and some stars. The show is on Twitter at The Deck Tees. I am always on Twitter at Original Estrus. And you can email me personally at estrus@elitistjerks.com. Thank you guys so much for listening and Feline for coming on the show. And take care of yourselves, okay? Bye.